fingers, mar his own reflection. Each night, looking a little older, more haggard than the last. At noon on Thursday, he sat alone at his lunch and took out Charlotte's letter, and ran a hoard thumb over the signature, going through all the ways he had failed her. On Friday, he held that letter over a lit candle and turned it this way and that as the flame ate towards his fingers, blaming her. All things must end, he told himself, not quite believing it. On Saturday, he stalked the rooms of his house and stood in the kitchen listening to the rain on the window, alone. There was a clatter, and then Mrs. Sykes materialized in the scullery door, a bucket of soapy water at her feet, her cautious grey eyes filled with pity. And he understood. Charlotte was gone. Nothing would bring her back. Mrs. Sykes shooed him down, set a kettle on the stove for tea.
"Revenge never set a scale to balance, Mr. Fool," she said. "Men like you ought to know that by now."
He thought of Alan Pinkerton, the old detective's relentlessness. He looked away.
"I lost my mister to the loop a lifetime ago now. Not a day goes by I don't think of it."
Mrs. Sykes pressed two scalded hands to the nape of her neck, tired.
"But I didn't never stop my own living on account of it. It weren't for me to do, if you take my meaning."
Fool squinted at her as if through a blurred glass.
"I had my Hetty, sir."
"Yes," he said slowly.
"Well, there's those what need you right here," she said, "and it ain't too late to save them."
"You mean Molly?"
"I mean Molly, why?"
She pressed her chin down into the soft of her throat.
"And I mean your own self, too."
It might have been Mrs. Sykes's words, or the passing of the days, or some third thing, but he awoke the next morning with a clear head, and a coldness taking shape inside him. His grief and shame were still there, but had dulled. He sat with Molly and Flood in the emporium, a low coal fire burning in the grate, trying to talk it through. Molly still knew nothing of his life as Edward Shade, and Fool, looking past her, glimpsed Flood's murderous expression and turned away. The giant had wanted it told, he knew, from the moment they left Pinkerton in that tunnel under the Thames, had thought it unfair for the girl not to know, to be a part of their crew, at risk, in peril, but oblivious to it.
"It ain't any way to manage a crew, Mr. Edam," Flood had said.
Now Molly scratched at the scabbed back of one hand, stared at the fire. Fool started to tell what Flood had already heard, the account of the séance, its implications. But when it came time to explain the story of Edward Shade, he glanced at Flood and paused, and then he left it out, surprised at his own hesitation. Molly listened to the rest, disbelieving, swearing a blue streak under her breath, leaning against a shelf with her arms folded.
"Pinkerton? Jesus!"
"I could kill him," Flood suggested quietly.
He turned a knife in the firelight.
"Could slick his ribs, be done with it."
Molly snorted.
"Right, and get every bloody beak in the city up for blood. Pinkerton's not just any blue leg. A touch like that like to get us more trouble than ever."
The giant shook his shaggy head.
"We disappear, then."
"Need blunt to disappear, chappy?"
"So we pull a job. Are we bloody flash touches, Astrey, or not?"
"And what job would that be?"
"Any job.
Just scoop up a bucket of blunt and be gone, is that it? Takes months to set up a grift. You've been in the jug so long you've forgotten how it goes."
She paused, her cheek lined in the silver light of the window.
"What's he up into, anyway? How did Pinkerton even know we're flesh?"
"Balls of brass, kid. Mr. Edam, it's your carriage. We're just riding it."
Fool, brooding, said nothing.
"Mr. Edam."
Slowly, Fool lifted his eyes. He met Flood's gaze. The fire smouldered in the grate. After a moment, he nodded imperceptibly.
"Tell her the rest," he said.
"Mr. Edam's got a history with the Pinkertons," Flood said abruptly.
"Why? We all do."
Then Molly bit at her lip, glared.
"What history?"
"With the old man himself, Ellen."
Molly was silent.
"Ellen Pinkerton were a major in the United States Army. During their war," Flood said, Mr. Adam served under him before deserting. Just a kid, not much older than you.
The giant scooped at his beard, glanced at Fool, at Molly.
What do the name Edward Shade mean to you, kid?
She shrugged, suspicious.
Why? What's he?
You never heard him talked about, in the flash houses like.
Bloody hell, just tell it already.
Edward Shade, Flood said, is the greatest thief in the smoke. Never been caught, never been touched. Half in the flash don't even think he's real. Other half never even heard of him. There's those in the yard what thinks he's a folk tale. But the Pinkertons believe. Shade's the Jake William Pinkerton come to London to find on account of his father. Old Alan hunted Shade for 20 years. It were a kind of obsession for him, like. Made him half crazy, by some accounts. Blamed Shade for any theft he couldn't solve. And even some he could. And now his son is at to seeing it through. Flood leaned forward, the chair creaking. Pinkerton had it that Charlotte Rickett, known Shade once. He were here to ring her. Nothing else.
Molly nodded slowly.
Then this Shade's to blame for what happened to her.
Something like that, aye.
So we nick him then, and clear ourselves with Pinkerton in the bargain. He'd give us a pass if we sewed up this Shade, I reckon.
She looked up.
How do we find him?
Finding him ain't the problem.
Flood paused, frowned.
You and me is both looking at him, kid.
Molly blinked, glanced uncertainly across at Fool in the firelight. Flood rose to his feet.
Meet the mysterious Edward Shade, kid, in the mighty flesh.
Molly stared past the giant, her face clouding, then suddenly fierce.
Edward Shade? That's your name, Adam? For real?
Lower your voice, kid.
You always said the past never mattered,
she said, ignoring the giant.
You always said it were today what makes us us. You and your bloody stories.
She whirled on Flood.
Pinkerton had a blood feud with him, and you never thought to tell me. Edward bloody Shade my ass.
You can see now why we got out of London,
Flood said quietly. She rubbed at her face, set a hand shakily on a chair.
Only place to hide from the Pinkertons, she said, is the grave.
Now Fool looked up from the fire, his eyes sharpening.
Not even there, he said.
At the sound of his voice, her expression again hardened. He could see her shock, the baffled hurt of it, but he offered no apology.
His past, for God's sake, was his own.
You're both right, he said softly. We need Blunt to clear our debts. Get out of the city.
He interlaced his fingers and he looked at his companions with a black expression.
And I know what we can steal to make that happen.
Edward had awakened on that first morning as an operative of the Secret Service of the Potomac, with his head aching and a smell of fresh coffee in the air. Sunlight had tangled itself in the curtains. He was alone. Someone had left a tray on the man Ben's empty chair, and when he lifted the silver lid he saw buttered toast, scrambled eggs, 3 thick slices of ham. He ate, he wiped his hands on his shirt, he sat on the cot, thinking. At last he rose and opened the door and stepped out into the alley. A black woman was taking down some washing from a line, and she paused over her basket and regarded him, and he looked past her for any sign of Major Allen's men. But then the woman snorted and addressed him by name, and he looked at her again, astonished, and she laughed.
Shoot,
she said.
You never reckon the Major was just going to leave you lonesome now?
She set 2 fingers to her mouth and whistled, and a moment later the huge black operative, Ben, came out of a door down the alley, wiping his mouth on his sleeve, his pistols and belt slung over one shoulder. Ben looked bigger, more scarred in the daylight. His nose flattened to a crooked angle as if it had been badly set years ago, his huge hands calloused and rough.
You eaten, then?
He said in his deep voice, but did not wait for an answer and only leaned down and kissed the black woman on her forehead, and then shoved past Edward towards the street with a grunt that he should follow. And so began Edward's training. He did not see Major Allen. As the days passed, he learned the slow, dangerous art of being a spy. Ben instructed him first on how to conduct a rough shadow, how to follow a mark, and be seen so that the mark could know he was being tailed. The trick, Ben said, was to remain aloof, not to lose the mark, but not to approach so near that you could be confronted. When Edward asked what to do if he was challenged, the man shrugged.
"Make the bastard nervous,"
he growled. With the scarred man spar, Edward learned to eavesdrop on conversations in cafes, in restaurants, in train stations. With Ben's wife Sally, he worried away at different accents, catching a Virginia lilt almost at once. On his fifth day, Spar seated him before a mirror with 2 dozen electric bulbs blazing around it, and pulled out a carpet bag filled with sticks of chalk and paint trays and dyes, and described the art of makeup and disguise. Edward learned to rely not on the altered appearance, but on the physical gesture that would distract a person's attention. He learned to walk quickly while appearing casual, to move slowly while appearing to hurry. He learned that nothing is as it seems, and that to trust one's senses is to trust a treacherous thing. Every night, Ben sat broodingly at the door to bar his way, hinting at Major Allen's furies, his rage, his impatience, his intolerance of failure or weakness of any kind. In the second week, Ben worked on Edward in a makeshift pugilist's ring in a depot warehouse near the rail yards. He knocked Edward down, knocked him down again. When the boy cried out, Ben cracked his knuckles in disgust.
"You think the Major gonna show you mercy?"
Edward was on his knees, the breath knocked out of him.
"Get up. I seen the Major take out a man's fingernails with a hot poker. You get on up now. You don't want to make the wrong impression, boy, when he tests you tomorrow."
Edward raised his bruised face.
"Tomorrow?"
Ben grimaced.
"I said get yourself up, boy. We're losing daylight here."
Fool's idea was simple. Steal a painting. But not just any painting, he said, watching his companions in the firelight. "It's called the Emma, and it's set to command £30,000 at auction." Flood gave a low whistle.
£30,000, he muttered.
"We could work it back for a third of its value and be gone without any warrant ever being issued." Molly, sullen, frowned.
"You want us to chalk out a bloody painting? A painting, Edward?"
Fool studied her until she blushed and looked away. He held up a hand, folding down his fingers one by one. An art heist could be set up and executed quickly, and it had never before been done, to his knowledge. The reason was obvious. A work of art of any value would be impossible to fence, being too identifiable. But this would make the target an easy one in that the security would be minimal, and they could negotiate the painting back to its owner at a fraction of its value, say, £10,000, in exchange for the dropping of any charges. This particular painting, this Emma, had made the front page of the Times at least once a week for months now, and its notoriety would ensure its value. They would employ their solicitor, Gabriel Utterson, to attend the exchange in their stead and negotiate on their behalf as legal representative.
"Utterson," Flood scowled. "You mean to trust him again? After everything?"
"We've worked together 14 years.
Fool withdrew from inside his frock coat a folded sheet of newsprint, and smoothed it out, and passed it across to the giant. It was an article on the painting.
"I don't muddy the waters, Japheth, when it comes to business," he said. "It's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of profits, and Gabriel understands profit."
Molly glared darkly at a spot in the carpet, hardly listening. Flood shrugged.
"Right. Supposing we agree. Supposing we reckon this a live possibility now. What do it require?"
"Just us. No outsiders. But I haven't cleared it all in my head. We'll need to know the building. Hours, routines. We'll need an approach and an exit. We'll need to know the gallerist and his resources. His name is George Farquhar. He's a wealthy man already, by all accounts. Famous in all the right circles. We'll want details, specifics, how he spends his leisure time, his wife's relations if he's married, where he lives."
"Timeline,"
Flood prompted. Fool rubbed at his whiskers.
10 days, maybe 2 weeks, not a day longer.
2 weeks,
Can't be done, Mr. Edom. Fool looked at Molly in the gloom. He shook his head. It has to be, he said. Monday afternoon arrived cold but dry, the London Zoological Gardens deserted. Fool had sent a runner to Utterson's offices that morning and received an immediate reply. The solicitor would see him at the gardens at 2 o'clock. He had descended into Piccadilly for a cab with his hat and walking stick under one arm, and Molly trailing sourly behind. Twisting a stubborn shoulder, solitary, quieter than usual. They walked now through the cold gardens, the two of them, a father and his daughter out for a winter stroll. A lonely keeper drifted along the paths, disappearing and emerging around the shrubbery. Molly ran her fingers through the low-hanging trees, leaving a trail of broken twigs. Fool said nothing. He peered up at the grey sky, glanced at the girl, shivered. The iron stakes lining the pens stood grim and dark, as if stained by shadow, the cages desolate and unswept. But there was still in the air that unearthly fug of animal fear as they passed the hippopotamus pool, emptied now of its water, the walls of its tank splotched and peeling.
"I ain't stupid," she said suddenly. "Don't look at me like that. You never asked me along to work Utterson into the blind, Edward."
"Stop that," Fool said.
"Stop what?"
Fool put out a hand, slowed her.
"I'm not Edward Shade," he said,
his voice gentling.
"It's true I was, once, but that person died in the war."
"That's a load of bollockin' fancy talk, and you know it."
He shook his head.
"It was a different life," he said,
"like what you lived with Mrs. Sharper and her sister. They're Birdie. You don't talk about her, who you were to them."
"But it ain't a bloody secret from you, neither."
Fool frowned. To their left, the monkey house loomed, shuttered and dead. At the elephant park, he stopped and leaned his elbows over the railing and looked at the ruins beyond, and there was a slick of ice visible in the drained pond.
"Mrs. Sharper, she cut me plenty," Molly said. "But you was different, Adam. You didn't never lie to me, not from the very first. I never asked you to tell me about your life before. It weren't mine to ask after. But—"
She fell quiet.
"What?"
She looked at him.
"Jappy knows you in ways I don't. It's embarrassing."
"Japheth and I go back 20 years. That's a long time."
She plugged up her bottom lip, grimaced.
"I weren't never Birdie," she muttered.
"You were to little Peter."
She shook her small head, her hair in her eyes.
"Peter,"
she said,
"I remember how it was, how you were.
Don't you bring Peter into this.
You're right.
I'm sorry."
She looked at him.
"I reckon the war were awful.
I could live 50 lifetimes and never get far enough from it."
He raised his eyes and saw a figure at the far side, watching them. The man wore a silk hat and a fur-lined coat buttoned high, and he knew from the shape of him it was Gabriel Utterson.
"Molly,"
he said, but she was already looking across.
"You should have told me," she said quietly. "That's the point."
They crunched their slow way around the enclosure, over the frozen grass.
"Your office would have been warmer," Fool called.
Utterson clapped his gloves, his breath smouldering in the cold.
"We have a problem, sir,"
he announced.
"William Pinkerton came to the house yesterday."
A quick, displeased sideways glance, his gloves all at once still.
"I did not speak to him myself. I was occupied at the office. But Rose insists he was rather aggressive. I understand he suggested some impossible relation between you and a certain elusive thief."
He heard Molly suck in her breath, and he looked angrily away. "We work our own jobs, Gabriel, you know that. We bring no one in."
"Who does he mean?" "Of course your business is your own, sir." "What thief? But I cannot be under scrutiny. I will not permit it."
"What thief, Gabriel?"
Utterson looked at him, his hard green eyes shining.
"William Pinkerton believes you are, you once were, the notorious Edward Shade."
Fool started to laugh, stopped.
"You are joking."
The solicitor's expression was blank, unreadable. Fool blinked, glared in bafflement at the elephant enclosure beyond.
What would give him such a notion? The damned seance?
"'Or the manner of your departure, perhaps,' Utterson said coldly. "'I did warn you. Sometimes Rose is successful. Sometimes, unfortunately, a sitter will—' "'What?'
"'Leave in disgust. Break the circle.'
Utterson held out his open gloves, fingers splayed. "'Rose did not mean to have upset you. But she didn't. It was Ignatius speaking, was it not?'
Utterson's thin lips were white and crackling in the cold, and Fool watched his tongue creep along their edges.
"'We do not select the gods, sir,' he said softly. "'We are conduits only.'
Fool frowned, weighing the truth of his words. The solicitor was all falseness and cruelty, but Fool could see no advantage in his betrayal. He felt Molly, tense, beside him. He knew she carried a stiletto in her boot. Knew, too, that he himself could strike Utterson to the pavement with the knuckle of his walking stick before she could even draw. At last he nodded.
"'You and I go back too many years, Gabriel, to play each other false. It would be too easy for either of us to ruin the other.'
The threat hung in the silence between them.
"'You asked to meet,'
Utterson said at last, his distaste sinking back into the folds of his flesh, his face taking on a flushed stillness once more.
"'What is the business?'
Fool took from his pocket a small gilded notebook and flicked through the pages. Stopped.
"'There is a man of considerable social standing. He will lose an item of great value to himself soon. Whoever recovers it will need someone to negotiate its return. For a fee, of course.'
"'Oh.' Utterson's eyes were narrow, lightless.
"'The poor gentleman.' I'm pleased to hear it will have a happy ending, but I haven't accepted such work in over a year, I regret to say.
It would be for the usual percentage. Utterson's voice was very low.
I'm not in the game anymore. I'm sorry.
Fool stepped forward.
I need to get out of London, Gabriel, because of Pinkerton.
If what you tell me is true.
Utterson paused, considering.
"'And it would be in my interest for you to absent yourself,'
he said slowly.
"'It would keep Mr. Pinkerton from my affairs. But you have debts, sir, and Mr. Barr has proven most patient already. Will the job prove so profitable?'
His shaggy eyebrows lowered as he caught Fool's expression.
"'Come now, I have heard of your investment loans. Do not look so surprised. You must learn to live within your means, sir.'
Fool frowned.
This job should fix that. It will need to reach completion rather soon, I expect.
Within the fortnight.
Utterson gave him a quick, sharp look. Haste, sir, is never an ally.
Not haste, Gabriel. A window of opportunity.
Ah.
If you agree, I'll be in touch with further instructions as I know them. Standard hook and line. After the job's been executed, I'll require you to reach out to the gentleman yourself. Suggest a neutral location to meet. One of us will direct him to you on the day of the exchange. Same as always. I expect he won't press charges.
Not if he wishes to negotiate, sir. It is illegal to buy back stolen property from declared thieves. You're certain he will cooperate?
Well, Fool peered up at the white sky. It's always easier when they do. Just then a keeper came whistling out of the trees, rolling a barrow in his arms, the wheel squeaking weirdly. He glanced bored across at them as he went, then disappeared towards the monkey house. Utterson took the notebook with George Farquhar's name and street address, and pocketed it, and nodded to them both, and then he walked swiftly back down one of the deserted paths and was lost to view. Fool watched him go.
"'I guess that's a yes,'
he said, turning to Molly. "'Your impression?' She glared after him.
"'I prefer the sister.'
"'Me too.'
But I don't reckon he set you up. Not with Pinkerton, at least. Fool nodded, brooding.
That's my sense of it, too, he said at last. William Pinkerton,
Molly muttered.
William goddamned Pinkerton.
She stared out at the grey light in the gardens, the trees wrapped in their heavy wadding to keep out the cold, like men turning into their collars. Fool set a hand on her shoulder. He felt her trembling under him like water in a ditch when a carriage rattles past, and supposed it must be the cold, and he thought again how young she was, feeling a sudden impossible sadness for the world as it was.
26. William Pinkerton had been alone with his rifle in a burning canyon in New Mexico when his father fell. That was in June. He did not hear of it until 8 days had passed, and he had returned to Santa Fe with a man roped and trussed to his own saddle. He threw his satchel over one shoulder and did not wash the desert from his face or hands, but rode at once for the railroad station and climbed aboard the first express heading east. All that long journey he stared at the passing fields, feeling nothing at all, and that nothing he knew would be in him for always. The old man had fallen on the sidewalk outside his house, and bit through his tongue, and septicemia set in. He was dying. When William walked into the front hall out of the evening sun, he was wearing a clean shirt, and his face was washed, but there was a ring of dirt around his collar and wrists, and he was carrying his satchel still. He took off his hat in the stillness and stared at the polished furniture in shadow, as if he had not seen it before. "Hello?" he called. He feared for a long moment that his father had already died. He walked the length of the hall, listening to his own footsteps, and opened the door to the morning room and crossed to the back porch and stood looking out. His mother was sitting stiffly on the swinging seat there, but when he let the screen door bang behind him, she looked up, her face drawn, and he knew it was not yet so.
"Oh, William,"
she said. He stood over her and enfolded her in his arms, and he held her like that, and when he let her go, the chains on the swing creaked. She wore a sun-faded green dress, and had pinned her grey hair, and she looked to William very old. He saw her glance at the house, and then back at him, and then she said,
"Did you just get in? You look hungry. Let me fix you a bite of something."
He shook his head. He was still holding his hat, and he put it down and sat in a wicker chair opposite.
"How is he?"
A shrug of her shoulder.
"He comes and goes. Robert's here."
"From New York?" She nodded. "I came as soon as I heard," William said. "I haven't even been home yet. Where are Margaret and the girls?"
"They were here this morning."
She smiled.
"They've been wonderful."
William nodded. "I'd like to see him," he said. His father was resting in the second-floor guest bedroom because of the light, and when William went in, he saw at once that the old man was near death. His throat was thin and corded, and his chest sunken, and the skin everywhere looked yellow in the evening glow. William would not have known him. He could speak only through one corner of his mouth, and the words came distorted and strange, as if he were speaking through a mouthful of cotton.
"William,"
his father said. He came to the edge of the bed.
"How are you feeling, Pa?"
A grimace, eyes closing.
"I heard you had a fall," William said.
He saw a thin tear crush out from the corner of one lid and trail down his father's temple into his thinning hair. He had never seen his father weep. He filled with pity and with something close to shame, and he looked away. There was a chair beside the bed, and he pulled it out and sat down, huge and clumsy in it. He did not know what to do with his hands. Then his father opened his eyes and stared at him, and his eyes were very pale and very clear.
"William,"
he whispered, "I'm here.
I don't want to die. Don't let them bury me."
"You're not going to die."
His father lay still and prostrate in the bed, and a white sheet was across his legs like a funeral shroud, and he worked his mouth, and he started to tremble. William was looking at him in his frailty and terror, and he wet his lips and swallowed, but he did not know what to say. He was his father's son, and too much so. The door stood closed behind them as if to keep the softness of the world out. It was a small room, and it caught the red sunlight aslant in its windows. The big willow was green on the lawn, and he could hear the gardener cutting back the rose bushes under the window. After a time, the old man closed his eyes and slept, and William sat on in the silence, his big hand on the old man's wrist, the bones there, light as paper. It was raining. He got down from the Omni and splashed his way through the setts and crossed into Great Scotland Yard, the water seeping through the collar of his coat. Inside the doors of Back Hall, he shook out his hat, brushed the beads of water from his arms. The floor was puddled, slick. He made his way downstairs to the freezing records closet. In his pocket he carried the folded telegram from his offices in Chicago. Because Shade had left no trace, no record, no paperwork, William had no legal cause to pursue the man, nothing that would stand in court and not be dismissed as intimidation or harassment. What he needed was a methodical approach. His first task, then, must be to create a trace of the man. Then he could identify Shade the next time he transgressed. For 20 years, Shade had haunted the streets, a subterranean figure, not even a suspect in his own crimes. Some grief had divided Shade from William's father in the war, some betrayal lost now to the grave, if Shaw's account could be trusted. Nearly lost, he corrected himself. There was still one, at least, who knew the truth of it. If only William could find him, make him confess. For he knew little more now, a month later, than he had known when Fool first approached him in that tunnel under the Thames. His father had wanted Shade held to account, true. But he did not know if his father's rage was cause enough for him, if it had ever been. There was in him, he knew, some part of his father that he would have better been without. He paused at the records door, gripping the handle, scowling at his wet shoes, while two constables stumped past, helmeted, eyeing him suspiciously. The hell with it, he thought. He'd see Shade in shackles yet. The records closet was a long, narrow, windowless room underground. Just within the door stood a cabinet with brooms and mops and a bucket, and beside this a small desk and a broken chair, which William suspected was used mostly by the groundsman on his night shifts. There were candles in their sconces set at the front and back of the room, but they gave very little light. The rest of the room was filled with shelves piled high with papers and boxes and cabinets, all labelled in a faded brown spidery script, nearly illegible now, and ordered to some system long since abandoned. William had gone in that first day baffled and belligerent, until a passing constable had shown him to the small cabinet with the files he was looking for, and he returned there now in his search for Flood. He was crouched on the floor when the door opened, and the candles guttered sideways. He glanced up. It was Blackwell.
"Mr. Pinkerton, sir,"
the inspector called in.
"I was told I might find you here. Have you a moment, sir?"
He shut the door, lowered his voice.
"It's about the Reckitt murder."
William stared. He had not given the case much thought since the séance. Blackwell shuffled forward, brushing against the loose papers. In his frock coat and silk hat, he seemed to cramp the narrow space.
"You were called in to identify her, sir, were you not?"
"Why are you whispering?"
"Whispering, sir?"
"Speak up, man. Yes, I saw her."
Blackwell cleared his throat.
"And were you certain about it, sir? The identification?"
"What is this about, Blackwell?"
The inspector frowned, uneasy.
"Is it possible, sir, that a mistake was made? Is it possible the dead girl is not Charlotte Reckitt?"
William thought of the woman he had mistaken for Charlotte in the street several weeks past, his frantic pursuit of her through the alleys, all at once interested despite himself.
"It's just that I might have found a lead, sir. From the drawing, sir."
"Go on."
"A publican's wife. She disappeared shortly before the body was found. Two separate men identified the drawing as bearing a resemblance. And the pub in question fits Dr. Breck's criteria, sir."
"What does the husband say?"
"I haven't approached him yet, sir."
William smoothed his moustache.
"You know it's likely nothing."
"Yes, sir."
"It's probably a mistake. You know that?"
"I do, sir."
"Does John know?"
"The chief?"
Blackwell blinked.
"I haven't written to Brighton, sir, if that's your meaning."
"Brighton?"
"The chief's in Brighton, sir. Did you not know?"
"What's he doing in Brighton? Holidaying?"
"In February, sir."
Blackwell smiled stiffly as if William had made some witticism.
"I should think not, sir."
He raised a hand to his collar, but his elbow caught on a leaning stack of reports and he bent swiftly, caught and righted them.
"Mr. Shaw isn't due back until day after next, but I wouldn't wish to waste his time, sir, if it is indeed a mistake. I have a tenement I'd like to make some inquiries at first, which she's said to have frequented."
Blackwell eyed the leaning stack of reports warily, then raised his face.
"What is it you're looking for here, sir? Might I be of assistance?"
William waved a hand as if it were nothing. Did you want me to talk to him?
Mr. Shaw?
The husband.
Oh.
Blackwell nodded in relief.
Well, sir, I should hate to go alone.
William gave the inspector a firm look. You just let me know when, he said, and then he started to turn back to his task. But Blackwell did not move and only stood peering at William in his damp clothes, and William blew out his cheeks.
Was there something else? The body, sir. To be clear, you were certain when you identified it?
I thought I was. John recognized her too, and there was a neighbor brought down from Hampstead who confirmed her as well, if I remember it right. William's legs were cramping and he got now to his feet, sore, feeling his age. If it's not Charlotte Reckitt in those jars.
Sir?
Then where the hell is she? Blackwell nodded.
I was thinking, sir, rather, whose body is it then?
William fumbled for his pipe. Well, he said, that too. Robert was folded in his shirt sleeves over the railing when William came down to the porch from the sick room. As his brother straightened and turned, his straw hat snared in the low-hanging oak twigs, and he plucked it, thornily free. The screened door banged shut. Summer hummed in the green. A dappled light was filtering through the leaves across his face, and William saw how his brother had aged. He had shaved his mustache since the winter, and his great round cheeks looked tired. And when he smiled, his lips were thinner, his jowls slacker. William had still not washed the travel dirt from his neck or wrists, but Robert came across and hugged him with a great, fierce embrace all the same. He could smell the expensive, perfumed aftershave at his brother's throat, and feel his brother's shoulder blades oaring under the tailored cotton of his shirt, and when he stepped back, he saw a grey streak of dirt imprinted on his brother's stomach. His waist had thickened.
"When did you get in?" Robert said.
His voice was low, somber, as if at a sickbed. William shrugged.
Are you here alone?
For now. I need to go back to New York tonight, but I'll be back Monday. I didn't want to bring the children yet. I didn't know what sort of condition he'd be in.
William nodded, squinted. The air was hot, still, rising up out of the ground.
New York?
He said after a moment. Robert belled his tongue against the wall of his mouth in a gesture William recognized from their father.
That mess in Hoboken with the postal employee. Our operative thinks he's found a way through it. I take it New Mexico was a success. I didn't have to kill the fellow, if that's what you mean.
Robert smiled.
That's what I meant.
The porch boards creaked under their weight. William was still gripping his brother's wrist, staring with the sober affection of an older brother who did not see as much of the younger as he would have wished. Even as a boy, Robert had displayed an inky smartness William had lacked. He would as soon read as write, would help his older brother with his schoolwork. He had graduated from Notre Dame's business college, then slipped to the New York office with George Bangs, and started plotting to open further branches, to widen the watchman patrol in its lucrative ordinariness. William, held up in Chicago under their father's brooding eye, famous for his drinking, gambling, camaraderie with thieves into the late hours at Mike McDonald's saloon, understood none of that. In contrast, his brother was calm, cool, all profit and calculation. It had ever been so. As a boy in the summers, William would wander down through the rapids in the small river below their house, seeking some crooked boulder to perch upon in his hunt for the biggest trout. Robert, quiet, stolid, would in the meantime dip current side to a proven eddy and haul out a half-dozen smaller trout. But his brother also was a man of great physical courage, and together they had ridden several times the outlaw trail with loaded rifles, and there was no man William would rather have at his back. Robert was fumbling now at his pockets, as if looking for something.
"You'll keep him alive until I can get back," he said.
William grunted.
"I'll just tell him we found a lead on Edward Shade." "Edward Shade? Good Lord."
There was a sound behind them. Their mother had drifted to the screened door and stood blurred in the cool of the kitchen, hands shielding her eyes.
"You boys hungry?"
"We're fine, Ma," William said.
"Bobby?"
Robert glanced back at her, then reached up and disentangled his hat from the oak leaves.
"Some of that cold chicken sounds good," he called,
raising his eyebrows at William as he spoke. His eyes were anxious, but he smiled a low smile and shook his head and added, in a conspiratorial whisper,
"Hell, Willie. Edward Shade."
He gave a quiet laugh.
"You know, talk like that could lead to a full recovery."
He was thinking of that afternoon as he returned through the rain to his hotel, thinking of his brother, of the summer's red sunlight, flush on his wrists, of how much he wished their father had lived to see him close in on Edward Shade. A dip in the footway outside his hotel had turned into a black puddle, and a crossing sweep stood next to it, brushing the water away as William approached and splashed through and went inside. It had been a strange finding of Shade, and even now he lacked any evidence beyond his own conviction. But that conviction was like steel. Never mind, Charlotte Reckitt. He did not know if Blackwell would prove correct in his investigations, but in the end it did not matter. She would turn up, one way or another. They always did. In the hushed lobby, the concierge saw him and waved him over. A package was waiting. It was heavy, and he felt the weighted slide of articles within, and he stared at it a long moment before deciphering the scrawl. It was from Sally Porter. He made his way back up to his room and shut and locked the door, and left the key in the lock, and then he began to strip himself from his clothes. The maid had been in, and a washtub stood half-filled with water that had cooled, but there was a ceramic jug of hot water stoppered up beside it on a stand, and a stack of folded towels and a bar of Pears soap. He stood holding his trousers in one hand, bare-legged, but still in his stocking feet, and he stared at the water. Then he went back into the front hall and took the package from the pier table and went into the sitting room, and sat half-naked with his white knees shining in the gloom. He cut the string carefully with a knife, and poured the contents onto the writing desk and withdrew the letter. The familiar, slanting hand, the cramped, spidery scrawl of the housekeeper Sally once had been. He sifted through the objects, a steel belt buckle, the snub-nosed twists of two bullets, a creased and folded Civil War photograph from Cumberland, 1862. William saw his father at the center. He saw Benjamin Porter as a young man at its edge. It was an image of the agents of the Secret Service of the Potomac. He opened the letter grimly.
"Dear Billy, I am writing this to you now because I believe you should know the truth of Edward Shade, no matter how strange the fashion of it seem. As it mattered to your father, it is not surprising it should matter to you. He would not have wanted it that way, but we do not always see eye to eye with our kin. And I know that now my Mr. Porter is gone, bless his soul. But I shall be straightforward with you, as God is my witness, and hold to my own conscience, if not to his. You do not get to choose the pattern if you do not make the quilt. Yes, I knew Edward Shade. He was an agent for your father in the Secret Service during the war, which I suspect you know, and not what you came to me for. But I will tell you what I know, and I hope it will help you to put some of this behind you. Lord knows your father did not ever manage it, and my Mr. Porter was loyal to him to the last. You will see his reproduction in the photograph I included here for you to know him. It is not a good likeness, I am sorry to say."
He held up the photograph and stared from face to face. In the front row, at one edge, a young man crouched, a boy yet, his face blurred and eaten by time. He could make no detail from it.
"Edward being small and quick, etc., and having no other object in view but his activities for your father, was an ideal operative. He was a strong boy of 14 when I knew him. I should not call him a boy. He was smart and likable both, and he had a gift for accents. Your father, I think, liked to think of him as a kind of adopted son, or that is how it seemed to me. Took him under his wing, tried to teach him his letters, etc. My Mr. Porter liked to say your father saw something of himself in the boy. They both had tempers, I can assure you that. But he always was proud of you and Robert. This had nothing to do with that. It was in the second year of the war, just before the Peninsula campaign, and the Union poor were then dying by the hundredth under the guns of the enemy. No, you had not come up from Notre Dame yet, I do not believe. The sight of it was very dispiriting, etc. Your father approached us and relayed that the general, that is, McClellan, who, as you know, your father loved more than any other man,
was in want of reliable information behind the Confederate lines. As we were a small group that he trusted, and as Edward was one of us, when he volunteered I was present, and I heard it myself, what some folks said later about coercion is a lie. No, I did not like it at the time, as Edward seemed very young to me, but it was not my place to say. 12th April being a new moon on that night, my Mr. Porter and me guided Edward down through a dry creek past the sentries, and Mr. Porter gave him the horse and carriage we were riding on, and sent him on his way. We returned on our own 2 feet through enemy country. 2 Negroes in the Confederate South on our way to Fort Monroe, and that was a walk I do not care to remember. 5 weeks after he crossed over, the report ceased. As that was the onset of a cold spring, and as we heard nothing more, your father, may he rest in peace, grew very agitated and anxious and sick, etc. On 1st July, he sent a Virginian operative south to inquire after Edward. I did not know the man well, but what I knew I did not like. Ignatius Spar was his name. I believe you knew him some. He was not a regular operative, and he never told a story about himself that was not flattering. Well, it is perhaps not the kind of me to write that. That summer, the Army of the Potomac was pushed off the peninsula, and it was a bad season to be issuing an operative. We all of us considered it ill-timed, even your father. When that Virginian too disappeared after reaching Richmond, I don't believe your father was under any illusions. He had received not more than 2 reports before the operation went cold. In August, Washington informed him both men, Shade and that Virginian Spar, had been arrested by the Confederate Secret Service and were being held in a military prison. He wet his lips. Spar and Shade? He thought of the spirit Ignatius whispering to fool at the seance, and he thought of Spar during that terrible retreat in the Peninsula campaign. Spar had vanished into the tree line at Malvern Hill, and William had always believed the man captured and killed by Confederate forces. Sally's account did not make sense, unless Spar had deliberately cut their balloon loose, had brought them down behind Confederate lines on purpose in order to get nearer Richmond. He furrowed his brow. Richmond, where Shade was. Billy, I do not like to write about that time. It is painful even now to think what that poor boy suffered. Maybe your father felt so too, and that is why he did not speak of it to you. I always did respect and love your father. He was a man of principle and feeling. But when he heard about Edward, he did not come out of his tent for several days. Were you on the front lines then? If so, then you will recall how much thinner he had become, and weaker, etc., and how there was in him a new and destructive color. I have seen it since, but not very often. Your father wanted to send a small raiding party consisting of his own operatives behind the lines to rescue his agents, but a general was opposed to it, and Washington refused to negotiate the exchange. I've always believed it was this, even more than the general's renunciation of his command, which embittered your father to the war. No man escaped unscathed, it is true, and true, too, the conflict was already felt by him to a personal degree, as I know you were brought in to run the lines. But Edward, when he volunteered, had asked only one assurance in exchange for his service, and that was to be returned, whether alive or dead, to the north. If dead, to be buried there. If alive, well, it does not matter, does it? Your father made him that vow. I watched him shake hands. There was a lantern burning in the tent. It was very solemn, and moving aside, etc. When, in the event, the hostilities ceased, at last your father's very first action was to journey south, through the devastation into Richmond, and there begin investigating the circumstances of Edward's disappearance. My Mr. Porter and me did not travel with him at that time. Instead, we remained in Baltimore, as there was much to be done in regard to a ring of stock thefts. But your father wrote almost daily. He had little hope of locating Edward alive after so long a period. He knew, after all, we all did, how pestilential the conditions in those prisons. After several weeks, he found a marked grave in the Confederate Army Cemetery in Richmond. It contained the remains of the Virginian operative, Ignatius Spar. The inscription told of his great sacrifice for the Confederacy.
Your father dug up the body and removed the bullets. I send to you now. They were in the Virginian's remains. It is clear he was shot and executed as a spy. No, we could not then, and I still cannot now make sense of the inscription. Perhaps it was a cruel kind of joke. That happened in the war, you will remember. Death became so common. Now, Billy, you asked about Edward Shade. I did not answer you, not truthfully. Edward survived the war. In 66, your father come home one night and ate with your mama in the kitchen like they did always do. When he gone up to his study, he found a boy was waiting there to shoot him dead, and that boy was Edward Shade. I should not call him a boy. He was a man by then. I do not know just what transpired between the two of them that night, but there was a struggle. Your father, he fought Edward down and he took his revolver. Edward got out through the window. 6 times your father shot into the night and 6 times he missed. Your father, bless his soul, was many things, but he was never a poor shot. If all that is not enough to make a man like your father crazy, then I do not know what would do it. He did not ever much talk about that night with Edward in his house, holding a loaded gun on him. As your father knew that if Edward did not die in that prison, it could only be by turning on the Virginian he had sent down and betraying him to the Confederates. It is not surprising your father felt betrayed himself. I do not know what else Edward could have confessed to, as I do not know which secrets he carried in him, but certainly he knew enough to make his life worth the preserving. Edward disappeared. We did not ever hear from him again. There was that nonsense later about the break-ins, the senator's residence, the stolen items posted in packages to your father. But I do not believe that was the doing of poor Edward. Your father thought, to the end of his life, that Edward would turn up again. That is what he was looking for. I do not know if it was vengeance or love in your father all those years. Perhaps both. My Mr. Porter and me, we have been on the private payroll of your father some 13 years to the day, with one overriding purpose and one only. We were to collect and report back on Edward Shade, and to apprehend him if possible. To this end, we have lived in San Francisco, New Orleans, Paris, and London, that last being 6 years now. Those reports, being uncertain at best, nevertheless, Alan did not ever stop his belief in Edward's existence. What do I believe? I believe Edward is dead. I expect he is lying in an unmarked grave somewhere out west, or maybe in South America. I believe your father felt grief and guilt and anger, and that anger kept him from seeing the truth of it. I believe you, Billy, would be wise to let the matter lie and go back to Chicago. What I have written here is the truth. God bless. When you read this, I will be gone from London. I shall look up my sister in California, if she is still alive, and God willing, I remain your loving, etc. He sent down the letter and rubbed at his face, the sharp stubble burning his palms, his thoughts slow. She had said nothing to him that morning of his visit, only to confide such details now. What had altered in her? If what she wrote was true, then the man fool had not lied to him, not entirely, when he told of his father holding a gun on Shade at his house. William got to his feet and crossed the room and crossed back. Ignatius Sparr had spied for his father and labored as an aeronaut in deep cover, and his father had never once told him. He had for many years after the war lived with a crippling guilt about Sparr's disappearance. His father had known the truth of it, and never said. He felt a sudden, unexpected fury. And Shade? Shade had betrayed them all. He ran his fingers lightly over the papers. He tried to imagine Sally Porter laboring over the letter, writing him the truth as she knew it, pouring sand on the wet ink, and lifting the pages, and reading them over with care. He thought of the regret she must have felt at deceiving him that morning. The bath in his bedchamber was cooling. "Go on. Find your sister, Sally," he thought. "Find your blood and make your peace." Outside, the rain was rattling the windows. He heard the maid knock with 2 soft knuckles at the locked door,
and then calling to him, but he did not answer, and after a time she went away. 27. In the morning a black regret overtook Fung. He paced the cluttered aisles in the Emporium, considering Farquhar, the painting, Pinkerton, while the old floorboards groaned underfoot. His knuckles were cold, but he did not request a fire. Flood had warned him against approaching the detective, but he had not listened, and nothing had come of it but complication and misfortune. So. And Molly had stared at him reproachfully when she learned what he had kept from her. But it was not his past, or not only that. He was never one to wallow in his own mistakes, but still he did not like making them, and he felt now only shame and disgust at having done so. He tugged at his whiskers. He glowered. "If you do not like your situation," he told himself angrily, "then change it." A weird, bright rain had started to fall when he went into the foyer and found Flood, huge and shadowy and disapproving, in the white, backlit glow of the windows. "I want you with us at the gallery," Fool said, and his voice was curt. "Change your coat." Flood set his hat on his head. "Aye." "Molly!" he shouted. But when he turned around, she was breathing hard at the foot of the stairs, and her foot was resting on a crate of Namibian war rattles, and she was looking at him in alarm. He corrected her ribbons and adjusted the lace in her cap, and he gave her pink dress a hard, appraising glance. She had done her hair in ringlets, despite the shortness of it, and the effect was strange, though suitably innocent for his purpose. Flood came back downstairs dressed in a faded black morning suit, with scuffs on the elbows, and the trousers high on his ankles, as if he had bought it from a dead man and he had coloured his beard and stained the moons of his fingernails like a labourer not used to daylight on a weekday. Fool grunted his approval, then took the bowler from the big man's hands and gave him a battered silk hat. He withdrew from his billfold several pounds and passed them across to Flood, and then he leaned out into the hall and called for Mrs. Sykes. She came in wiping the backs of her hands on an apron, and untying its strings, and folding it over one arm, her hair wild, a streak of flour on her chin. "Mrs. Sykes," he said, "how would you like to take the morning off?" She looked at him as if he had just poured salt in the marmalade.
"What? And double the work for tomorrow? I'd guess not."
Fool frowned.
"I'd like you to go with Mr. Flood to an exhibition of paintings. Would you be willing?"
"Now, Mr. Fool," she said tightly, "there's a goose in the pantry. If it don't get dressed, it's going to be getting back up onto its 2 feet and walking out of here on its own, leaving you lot eating lentils and potatoes and not a thing else."
Fool raised an eyebrow.
"Mrs. Sykes," Flood said, and cleared his throat, "you got to think of it as a holiday, like."
"A holiday?"
she said.
"Aye,"
Molly laughed.
"All Souls Day. What with him on your arm?"
"Mr. Flood will be your companion, Mrs. Sykes," Fool said. "It would be a great favour to me, unless you feel the two of you might need a chaperone."
She flushed and turned her face away. But when Fool saw the wounded look on the giant's face, something inside him turned to ash.
"Forgive me," he said, his voice gentler. "I shouldn't tease. Japheth, you go on and bring Mrs. Sykes when she's ready. We'll proceed apace."
"What about Hetty?"
Molly asked.
"She don't get a holiday too?"
"You ain't in the house," Flood muttered. "That's the holiday for her."
Edward was taken to the Major's office in the third week of April 1862. The bearded Scot stood at a window in his vest, distracted, his back to the room and his hands folded behind him, and the fingers flexing silently. He did not turn. His shirt sleeves had been folded back and rolled to the elbow. Edward studied his broad back nervously, his shaggy black hair. Outside it had started to rain.
"I understand you might have the makings of an operative after all,"
the Major said at last, returning to his desk. His voice was low, subdued. His eyes looked tired.
"I have an assignment for you. I'm told you can read."
Edward was passed a slip of paper. On it was an address, a handwritten description of a woman. Tall, aristocratic, widowed, tight auburn curls, eyebrows a little too thick, a mold to the left of her nose, speaks with a Texas lilt. The paper did not identify her beyond this, nor was Edward told her name. He was to find her and shadow her during the day, but under no circumstances was he to approach her. He did not know if it was a test or a genuine operation, but he was surprised at the seriousness he felt in his labours. As he trailed her carriage across the capital and memorized the addresses she visited, he let himself imagine the major's interest in her was not professional. Certainly she was a beauty. There was a lithe grace to her, both predatory and haunting, and he watched her auburn hair dip across her face as she bent to smooth her skirts. It had rained all the week previous, and the roads were mudded and the widow's carriage rattled high over the ruts. Edward, quick on his feet, kept the carriage in sight with little difficulty. The widow visited several elegant homes in the West Quarter, and on the third day lunched with a member of the general staff. Edward understood this by studying the officer's uniform, although he did not know the man. Daily he watched, brooded, slipped along the streets, and as he did so, he felt for the first time his new power, the delicious power of secrecy, of trailing a victim unseen and unknown, and holding her fate in his hands. But nothing happened. For 4 days he followed her, memorized her movements, recorded her moods. He witnessed nothing incriminating. He feared his observation had failed. But the major did not appear disappointed. On the contrary.
"We'll catch that spider yet," he grunted.
He did not smile, but his hard eyes crinkled at the corners. "You did a fine job of it, lad," he said, and picked a piece of tobacco from his lips. Edward could not recall the last time a kindness was spoken to him with such ordinary ease, and he stared at his shoes, uncommonly touched, a lump in his throat. Fool would have liked to have walked. Instead, Flood strode down through the rain to a cab stand at the gates of Green Park and brought a hansom back up to Half Moon Street. When the driver climbed down, he punched open an umbrella patched with grey squares of oilcloth, and this he held blooming above Molly's head as she came down from the house. Then he hurried back to Fool, but Fool waved him irritably off with his walking stick. His hands were red in the cold, and he looked up at the house as if to go back in for his gloves, but he decided against it. The hansom was new and well-sprung, with a blue wool blanket laid out upon their knees, and they rode through the cold in a smooth and almost dreamy comfort. The rain had tamped down some of the city's stink, or perhaps Fool was growing used to the smells. He could not be certain which. Molly smiled her sweet smile, pointed to sights as they passed, played her role of innocence like a star turn upon the boards. As they clattered east down Piccadilly, they passed the walls of the park and the ancient brick edifice of Devonshire House, with its iron railings gleaming in the bright rainfall, and at Old Bond Street, Fool banged on the roof of the hansom with his walking stick that the driver should turn north. They drew to a stop outside the entrance to the Burlington Arcade. Across the street stood Farquhar and Sons' Fine Arts Galleria. The gallery had not been built to be ugly. Fool's glance from the halted cab was casual and haughty, as if merely double-checking the address. But in its stonework, he saw balance and rigour, despite the gaudy columns added to its entrance, already pitted and soot-stained, wrong in a false Italian style, and garish like brass earrings on a young beauty. The stone blocks of its façade were large, the masonry deep. On the wide sills stood low, sharp iron railings like an invitation to a burglary. He smiled cheerfully, and Molly smiled back. The windows were lit and shining through the rain, and he could see, even at that distance, the bovine shapes of ladies ascending the steps and moving through the rooms two by two, like visitants to some foundered ark. An art heist. It had never been done before, so far as Fool was aware. There was, as Flood had sworn, little sense in it. Fool suspected this would be both the challenge and the grace. He would need to approach it as he would approach any bank job or vault job, but he would need as well to be mindful of the differences. Inside was the tall, cold room with the wrought iron chairs and tables and ladies.